Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink, technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
And I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, President Bush in Africa. How does his trip compare so far to President Clinton's?
Donald Rumsfeld's startling new estimate of costs in Iraq. Why is the number so high?
And people power in China? 500,000 protesters in Hong Kong get what they wanted, for now anyway.
Hong Kong isn't a democracy, but it's an extremely free society. It takes an awful lot to get people in Hong Kong to mobilize and be angry.
Also, saving a rare fish, the Gila chub, from Arizona's fires.
And legendary Latin music maestro Eddie Palmieri. He's in his 70s, but just try sitting still when he strikes up the band.
Those stories and your letters coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. In his tour of Africa this week, President Bush vowed in Botswana, "You will not face this enemy alone." He was speaking of AIDS, of which Botswana bears the highest infection rate in the world. The Bush administration has promised $15 billion to combat the disease, and a bulk of it is slated for Botswana, where 4 out of every 10 adults lives with HIV. President Bush's trip in Botswana wasn't all business today. He toured a wildlife reserve, and NPR's Don Gagne has more on that.
This has been a busy trip for the president, hitting 3 countries in the first 3 days, with most of his time either spent in meetings with African leaders, at official events, or traveling from one country to the next. But the president did spend an hour here at the Mokolodi Nature Reserve. He toured the 18-square-mile home to endangered species, which roam about protected from their natural predators. The president was joined in a yellow pickup truck by his wife and his daughter Barbara. They saw a mother rhinoceros and her baby, assorted warthogs, a herd of antelope, and even a pair of elephants who just happened to be mating as the presidential pickup truck rolled past. Tomorrow, the president heads to Uganda before wrapping up his trip in Nigeria Saturday. Don Gagne, NPR News, with the president in Botswana.
The conflict in Iraq claims 2 more American lives. Last night, 1 soldier was killed in a rocket-propelled grenade attack. Another was gunned down in a separate incident. The killings bring to more than 30 the number of American soldiers killed by hostile fire since President Bush declared the war in Iraq was over May 1st. A spokesman for Britain's prime minister says Tony Blair remains confident that weapons of mass destruction will be found in Iraq. The comments come in response to a report from the BBC quoting a senior government source saying he doubted banned missiles or chemical weapons would now be discovered. The BBC's John Devitt has more.
Mr. Blair's spokesman gave a carefully phrased response to the BBC's report. He said he was absolutely confident that evidence would be found in Iraq, not only of weapons of mass destruction programs, but also concrete evidence of the products of those programs. The spokesman wouldn't clarify whether that meant actual weapons would be found or their component parts. The senior government source who spoke to the BBC said it was now thought that the weapons themselves would not be found, although it was likely that evidence from Iraqi scientists, paperwork and documents would reveal that weapons programs had been in place.
The BBC's John Devitt. Meanwhile, France says it'll only send troops for peacekeeping efforts in Iraq if the United Nations gives the word. The French foreign minister comment came a day after U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld called for support from other countries. On Wall Street, the Dow's down 118 points at 9,037. This is NPR. In this NPR business update, Americans paid higher prices for imports in June, while the Labor Department reports prices for U.S. exports have fallen. Steve Beckner of Market News International reports.
Import prices rose 0.8% last month, reversing a May dip. The increase was due in good part to a near 5% rebound in petroleum import prices after 3 straight monthly declines. But non-oil prices also rose, led by industrial supplies and materials, especially natural gas. Prices for finished goods rose moderately. Prices for imported autos, parts, and engines increased for the 2nd month in a row and were up 0.7% over the past 12 months. Over the past year, consumer import prices were unchanged. But in recent months, the dollar's fall against other currencies has been reflected in increased import costs. A weaker dollar makes U.S. goods cheaper for foreigners to buy, and in June, export prices fell 0.2. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
The number of Americans claiming jobless benefits has hit a more than 20-year high. The Labor Department said today that claims rose by 87,000 last month in the week ending June 28th to 3.8 million. The government also says first-time claims for unemployment insurance jumped by 5,000. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan says some industries are feeling the pain from high natural gas prices. Speaking before a Senate panel, Greenspan said he didn't think the days of relative abundance and low prices would return anytime soon. The Fed chairman also said that new drilling technologies have not been able to stem the rise of gas prices. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush spent his third day in Africa today, where he told Botswana's president that AIDS is the deadliest enemy Africa has ever faced, a comment that echoed statements he made in Senegal Tuesday and yesterday in South Africa. More than 38% of Botswana's adult population is infected with HIV. While Mr. Bush has been clear-cut about AIDS, he's been less so about civil unrest in Liberia. He's still stopping short of offering military support there. Joining us now from South Africa to assess President Bush's trip so far is Christian Science Monitor reporter Nicole Itano. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you.
First, let me just ask very simply, any surprises on this trip so far?
Not really. President Bush has really issued the same kinds of refrains we expected him to for the last several weeks. He's talked about AIDS. He's talked about trade. He's talked about the need to promote security and end civil wars in Africa. But none of this has really been new, and there haven't really been any new initiatives announced here.
What's the mood around the trip, Nicole? Is there a sense of excitement among Africans, or does it all feel very kind of scripted and distant from ordinary Africans?
Certainly this trip is far more scripted than President Clinton's trip here several years ago. And I think that Africans view George Bush with a lot more skepticism than they viewed his predecessor. When Clinton came here, he went through the streets of Soweto and tens of thousands of people came out to cheer him. He was mobbed in Ghana and in Senegal by people who just wanted to see him and have their pictures taken with him. And you really haven't seen that same kind of outpouring around President Bush's visit. His visit has been very scripted. He's met with lots of leaders, but he hasn't gotten out into the streets to meet real Africans. And I think that's partly because they knew he wasn't going to get the same kind of reception if he did.
He did seem to get a pretty warm reception in Botswana today, did he not?
Yes, and I think that Botswana is probably one of the more pro-American countries in Africa, certainly. In South Africa, there's been a lot more skepticism, and I think particularly because people here were very anti-war, and that sentiment is something that they still haven't really given up on. And despite these new promises for $15 billion for AIDS and $15 billion for development assistance, that really hasn't changed people's attitudes towards the president.
Observing close up, as you did in South Africa, what did you make of his encounter with President Thabo Mbeki there? Mbeki, of course, has been reluctant to distribute antiviral medications for AIDS. He's made statements in the past that HIV doesn't cause AIDS.
Well, I think the presentation that they made, and they had a press conference together yesterday, was very, very jovial. I mean, they were joking with each other. They were downplaying any differences on Iraq and Zimbabwe and AIDS. That said, I think that there are still divides on issues like Zimbabwe, like AIDS. For example, President Bush has earmarked 50% of his new $15 billion for AIDS, specifically for treatment. President Mbeki has even expressed doubt about the effectiveness of antiretrovirals and the link between HIV and AIDS.
A divide over Zimbabwe as well.
Yes, certainly. Though I think that we did see an increase in understanding as a result of this trip. Colin Powell last week had an editorial in the New York Times where he sharply criticized South Africa's government for not taking a stronger stance on Zimbabwe. But what we saw emerging at the meeting was, I think, a sort of increased understanding between the two countries. President Bush said he will continue to criticize Zimbabwe for its political rights violations, but at the same time, he respected Thabo Mbeki as a mediator and as a point man for discussions about Zimbabwe.
Nicole, Liberia, what's your sense at this point as to whether the U.S. is likely to bring any military support into that country, and how is the U.S. policy going down in Africa?
The president has said he hasn't yet made his decision, but indications seem to be that the United States is leaning towards sending technical assistance for a West African peacekeeping group.
Right.
In terms of the reaction on the continent, there's a summit going on right now in Maputo, in neighboring Mozambique, and a group of ministers there did come out very strongly asking the United States to send troops to Liberia. So I think that there is a sense generally on the continent that the United States should do something to improve the situation in Liberia.
Nicole Itano, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Nicole Itano is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. She joined us from South Africa.
Pentagon officials are changing their tune on the cost of operations in Iraq. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld told Congress yesterday that the estimated cost to feed, house, and equip soldiers in Iraq is $3.9 billion a month, not the $2 billion a month the Pentagon was estimating just last April. Also, retiring General Tommy Frank said troops could be there a while longer than they planned. Joining us on the line is retired Army Colonel Kenneth Allard, who is an adjunct professor at Georgetown University and military analyst for MSNBC. Welcome, Colonel.
Glad to be here.
How do you account for this huge increase in the estimate? It wasn't a little bump. It was doubling what they were saying just in April.
Well, Mr. Rumsfeld, you know, kept insisting that, their plans were perfect. They may have been during the war, but, during the peace, things really, really get complicated, and that's exactly why you're saying these estimates have, shall we say, a slightly more conspicuous ring of truth to them.
Well, what's changed exactly? Is it a need for more weapons or more people or what?
It's actually all of that. There is also a significant amount that you've got to ascribe to the cost of helping to rebuild the Iraqi infrastructure. The thing that is interesting right now is the fact that what appears to be the case is that the strategy for rebuilding Iraq, for winning the peace, is not nearly as well-developed and as well-thought-out as it was to win the war itself. And we're having to do many of these things far too late in the game to satisfy most of us.
So basically what the Army thought it would be doing right now in Iraq would be basically a peacekeeping mission, and in fact, they're still fighting a war.
They are fighting an insurgency. The I word is what no one wants to say, but that is exactly what they're fighting.
And along that line, Senator Ted Kennedy yesterday said that he was concerned that we have, quote, the world's best trained soldiers serving as policemen in what seems to be a shooting gallery.
I share his concern, as does anybody who has got their people over there. When you face an insurgency situation, a guerrilla conflict, it can be likened to a shooting gallery, and the only way to deal with it is to be very determined about what your objectives are and be equally determined about the resources you devote to them.
Well, Secretary Rumsfeld also said that there were 19 more countries that are going to be sending troops to Iraq to relieve Americans. Is this a token force, do you think, or will there be enough new troops to get more American soldiers home sooner?
Remains very much to be seen. A number of countries have indicated that their support for this depends very much on whether, in fact, there is a UN presence to support a peacekeeping mission. So it may very well wind up being the case that we have eventually got to come to terms not only with our allies, but for some potential role with the UN.
Mm. And Republican Senator John McCain seemed to be tapping Secretary Rumsfeld a bit on the wrist. He was urging him to provide a concrete plan to the public. And I wonder, as a military man, what does that tell you about Republican support for the post-war effort?
That was a shot across the bow. It is time to figure out what the U.S. strategy is going to be to come clean about what it's going to take both to execute that strategy, to carry it out in the long term.
And finally, when the secretary said that he really didn't know how much it might cost for operations after October, do you find that troubling?
Very much so. We all understand that any estimate has to be balanced against experience and against the realities that you may not have anticipated. But to say, well, I really don't know, that simply does not cut the mustard.
Well, Colonel, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
Retired Army Colonel Kenneth Allard is an adjunct professor at Georgetown University and a military analyst for MSNBC. The U.S. Supreme Court ruling that invalidated sodomy laws in Texas is already affecting new cases before the courts. A former Army lieutenant colonel, a decorated Vietnam veteran, has now filed a suit challenging the military's anti-sodomy statute and the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. The Army discharged Steve Loomis in 1997, just 1 week short of his retirement date. As a result, Loomis was not eligible for his pension, which he says is worth $1 million. Joining us now to talk about the case is Dixon Osborne. He is executive director of the Service Members Legal Defense Network. Hello, Dixon, and thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
Start us off with the facts of the case here. What happened?
Well, Lieutenant Colonel Steve Loomis was discharged from the Army 1 week before his 20-year retirement. And the Army discharged him based on a videotape they received from a civilian arson investigator. What had happened is that somebody had set fire to Lieutenant Colonel Loomis's house, burned it to the ground, and civilian investigators were rummaging through the rubble of it looking for clues. They came across a camera and a videotape that depicted Lieutenant Colonel Loomis engaging in private sexual conduct. And rather than discarding it, because it had nothing to do with the arson itself, they turned it over to the Army, and the Army used that as the sole basis to discharge him from the military. It did so just 1 week before his 20-year retirement date, and that meant that he lost everything.
Well, this was a personal videotape. Aren't there some real privacy issues here, too?
Well, this is the issue that is raised by the Supreme Court decision in Lawrence versus Texas, is that the Supreme Court 2 weeks ago argued or concluded that the Constitution forbids states from intervening and interfering in private sexual conduct. That is exactly what this videotape is about, and it's exactly what Don't Ask, Don't Tell is about. You have the federal government that is stripping people of their livelihoods and of their economic well-being simply because of private sexual conduct. And so the Supreme Court decision that came down really raises very serious questions about the continued validity of the military sodomy statute, as well as Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Which of these issues do you think concerns Steve Loomis more? The chance that he can get the military's anti-sodomy laws overturned, or does he just want to get his pension?
Both of them are deeply concerning to him. He truly believes that Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the sodomy statute are unconstitutional. Until the Supreme Court provided its guidance, though, 2 weeks ago, those arguments probably would have fallen on deaf ears, because we've had the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in place for 10 years. There have been a number of court cases that had decided to defer to the government on this, but they did so without any kind of guidance from the Supreme Court about, are there any constitutional rights that would protect gay people in the privacy of their homes? So the legal landscape has changed.
One last question. Do you see this as the best case against the military's policy?
Well, I think this is a very strong case. Colonel Loomis is somebody who served our country with great honor and distinction for 20 years. And the open question is, if sodomy laws are unconstitutional throughout the country, does that indeed also invalidate the sodomy law in the military, and does it invalidate Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Thank you, Dixon.
Thank you.
Dixon Osborne is executive director of the Service Members Legal Defense Network.
Just ahead, protesters in Hong Kong challenge Beijing's authority, testing the limits of one country, two systems.
And later, Eddie Palmieri leading the pack in Latin music.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, for the second time in 3 months, China's communist leadership's backed down, a direction they're not accustomed to moving in. First, Beijing admitted there really was a SARS problem. Now the leadership's man in Hong Kong, Chief Executive Tung Chi Hwa, has postponed imposing a so-called anti-subversion law after 500,000 people took to the streets last week to protest what's known as Article 23. Is this people power? Well, to explore that question, we're joined now by Robert Broadfoot. He heads a political risk consulting firm in Hong Kong. He's currently in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And welcome, Bob.
Hi, how you doing?
And for some perspective from mainland China, Susan Lawrence joins us from Beijing. She's senior correspondent there for the Far Eastern Economic Review. And welcome to you, Susan.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Let's begin, Bob Broadfoot, with you, if I may. What are the laws that govern Hong Kong? Chinese flags fly there, of course, but what is something called the basic law?
Well, the basic law is Hong Kong's constitution. It was set up to be the framework to govern Hong Kong after the handover in 1997.
I see. So what is Article 23?
There are steps under the basic law that have to be taken over periods of time, one of which is an anti-sedition law, which is Article 23, and a second is a more democratic form of government. There is an open time frame on some of these, but they're both specified under the basic law.
What would Article 23, which 500,000 people turned out to protest last week, have imposed on Hong Kong?
Nothing much. The wording of Article 23 would have, theoretically, it could have affected freedom of speech. It could have affected freedom of association. The way it's been worded is very watered down. The disagreement isn't over the article. It's how the government tried to introduce it and pass it without a debate, without consulting the people through a white paper. And that, more than the article itself, is what people are really upset by.
Huh. Now I've read that Article 23 would have granted unprecedented rights to search homes, to imprison journalists, to arrest citizens affiliated with groups like pro-Tibet groups in Falun Gong. It wasn't all that serious?
Not really. The problem was when they were originally announcing it to the public, they didn't give any specifics, so we didn't know what it was. And the more that the people resented that, it got in charge of the Bar Association, the head of the Catholic Church. Various influential leaders said, wait a minute, something's wrong here. This could impinge upon us in ways that we're not comfortable with. They're not comfortable with it because they really didn't see the specifics, and that is what has really, this inability to communicate is where the Hong Kong government's in trouble.
Perhaps an inability to communicate by chief executive in Hong Kong, Tung Chi Hwa. Now, Susan Lawrence, how is this all going down in Beijing? Are people there aware of that?
There's very little awareness in the mainland about what's just happened in Hong Kong. We still, of course, have a completely controlled media in the mainland.
Right.
The only public recognition of that was a foreign ministry press briefing in which the foreign ministry spokesman was asked questions by journalists, foreign journalists, about this and made some answers. That briefing was put on the web, so people who surf the web saw it, but your average Chinese person has no idea.
Well, will this have rattled the leadership in Beijing that 500,000 people turned out and that the chief executive at Hong Kong was forced to back away from Article 23?
Sure. I mean, it's definitely rattled them. It's not quite clear whether this is a Beijing back down or quite what's happened. There's a sort of odd relationship between Beijing and Hong Kong. So although ultimately, yes, Beijing calls the shots, it's very shy about being seen to be doing that.
Uh-huh.
And so everything that's happened in Hong Kong, Beijing has presented this as a set of events which have taken place in Hong Kong with Hong Kong people as the actors.
Yeah,
I have a question on it. From my perspective in Hong Kong, what we've noticed in the past couple of days is that some of the mainland newspapers in Hong Kong are being critical of Tung, which wouldn't happen without some agreement from Beijing. The line and the belief in Hong Kong prior to the SARS problem was that Beijing would keep Tung no matter what because he's their man. But since SARS, they've gotten rid of the health minister there. There was a submarine crisis where they got rid of the head of the Navy. Do you think it's possible that Beijing would fire Tung?
I'd actually like to get straight with the legal basis for this because my understanding is it's incredibly difficult for them to do anything about him. That because he's not elected, there isn't really a clear way that he could be removed before 2007 when his term is up.
In any event, Bob Broadfoot, are we seeing a degree of people power in Hong Kong, or is that an illusion?
I think you see people power. I think Hong Kong isn't a democracy, but it's an extremely free society. And it takes an awful lot to get people in Hong Kong to mobilize and be angry. I've been in Hong Kong since 75, and it's only happened about four times in that space. So I think what you're seeing is a degree of disenchantment with government policies and the way the government's communicating with people, a gap that is really quite unprecedented in the modern history of Hong Kong.
Do you have a sense that Article 23 ultimately will be imposed, these anti-subversive laws so-called in Hong Kong?
Yes, I think Article 23 will be imposed.
Hmm.
I don't know, though, if the government, if Tung Chee Hwa will be able to survive. And if he does stay in power for that 4 years, I don't know if Hong Kong if this is going to be such a dark cloud that Hong Kong will be unable to move into higher gear as an economy. And that ultimately is what people are really upset with, is we're in a depression or in a deflationary period, and that makes people very unhappy.
Robert Broadfoot, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
And Susan Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us from Beijing.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Susan Lawrence is a senior correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review. Robert Broadfoot heads a political risk consulting firm in Hong Kong.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, ever heard of smart mobbing? It's affecting everything from warfare to campaigning for office.
And the death of the free obituary. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the importance of wrapping heart attack victims in cold. It's called chill therapy.
Also, rescuing a rare fish from the fires in Arizona.
Basically, everybody put on their hip boots or their chest waders and just got into the pools and into the creek and pulled out the gear and collected fish.
And we listen to Eddie Palmieri's latest recording, Ritmo Caliente, Hot Rhythm, with our reviewer, Jose Masso.
Right now, with the death of Tito Puente 3 years ago, Eddie has now become the keeper of the flame, and he's the one who's kept this type of music alive, both in dance and in jazz, Latin jazz.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Federal authorities have searched 18 U.S. businesses as part of an investigation into arms shipment to Iran. No arrests were made, but 7 grand jury subpoenas were served on the firms. U.S. officials say the companies are suspected of supplying prohibited military items to a London-based front company that supplies the Iranian military. Attacks on American troops continue in Iraq. In the latest violence, one soldier was shot and killed about 15 miles south of Baghdad. A second soldier was killed, another wounded in a grenade attack in northern Iraq. Several mortar attacks have also been reported today. President Bush says the U.S. is dealing with what he calls a security issue in Iraq. Speaking with reporters during his trip to Africa, the president blamed the attacks on U.S. troops to a small number of Saddam Hussein loyalties. The president is in Botswana today, which is the world's highest rate of HIV infection. 40% of adults there have the virus.
We cry for the orphan. We care for the mom who's alone. We are concerned about the plight and therefore will respond as generously as we can.
General Tommy Franks is echoing President Bush's message about the continuing attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq. Franks testified before the House Armed Services Committee today, saying the U.S. military is now conducting stability operations in Iraq.
Much dangerous work remains to be done. The media reminds us of that fact every day. But you know, millions of Iraqis have freedoms today which they only dreamed of a year ago. And the regime of Saddam Hussein is no longer in power.
A ranking Democrat on the committee says the U.S. failed to plan the post-war operation and could be in the throes of guerrilla warfare in Iraq for years to come. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan says high natural gas prices are starting to hurt some U.S. industries. He told a Senate panel it is unclear if the effects will be permanent.
Today's tight natural gas markets have been a long time in coming. And distant futures prices suggest that we are not apt to return to earlier periods of relative abundance and low prices anytime soon.
Wholesale gas prices last week were double what they were a year ago. On Wall Street at midday, the Dow is down 119 points at 90.38. It's 33 minutes past the hour.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Doctors may soon start giving heart attack patients a radical new treatment, cooling their bodies on ice. The American Heart Association has endorsed chill therapy for patients who are comatose following a heart attack, saying fewer die and suffer brain damage. So how does this work? Dr. Terry Vandenhoek helped write the Heart Association's endorsement. He's a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Chicago. And welcome, Dr. Vandenhoek.
Hi.
Tell me, how does this procedure, this chill therapy, work?
Well, the chill therapy that was used in the recent studies that the American Heart Association and other associations evaluated used cooling blankets and essentially ice bags applied to the patient.
So this is not for any heart attack victim. This is for a victim who's had such a severe heart attack that they've gone into a coma.
Correct. These are patients who actually their hearts have stopped, and it's called sudden cardiac death. And there's a certain group of patients who we can get back. We can restart their heart with defibrillators, but many of them will have brain damage because of the amount of time that they've been without oxygen. So it looks like there's a group of these patients that may benefit from being cooled for a period of time to the extent that they actually could go back home and go back to work.
Do you have any idea how many victims of this sort of heart attack there are every year?
Well, official estimates are in the United States alone, there may be up to 600 patients, 700 patients a day that have
wow.
a sudden cardiac arrest. It may be as high as 1,000 a day.
That's extraordinary. Who first thought of trying this therapy?
Well, the concept of using hypothermia for treating low oxygen or low blood flow is, goes back to the 1950s. Mm-hmm. It's been used in surgical procedures. And the idea of using it for cardiac arrest patients also goes back decades. What's changed is the study that was done, particularly in Europe and Australia, narrowly defined a group of patients who had a witnessed cardiac arrest, who whose hearts were working after they were defibrillated, but were in a coma. And so that's a small subset of patients who survived their cardiac arrest, probably less than 10%. But if we can identify those patients quickly, either out in the field or in the emergency department, we may be able to initiate cooling and get some of those people back.
Now, how quickly do you have to start cooling a patient after the heart attack?
The remarkable part is that it, on average, took about 8 hours to get these patients cooled down to the target temperature, which was cooling them down just a few degrees. But despite the fact that it took that long, they still had a significant benefit. They decreased the mortality seen at 6 months, and they increased the likelihood of patients being able to live independently and go back to work. The benefit may be possibly even greater if we can initiate cooling faster.
Why does it work?
There's probably a lot of answers to that question. It may decrease the amount of inflammation that's present after cardiac arrest. When tissue is without oxygen for even a few minutes and then you bring back oxygen into that tissue, it can initiate a whole sequence of events that can be very damaging. And hypothermia may decrease that sequence of events.
Are there risks in all this, Doctor, at all?
Well, because you're decreasing inflammation, it's, you know, that's part of the immune system, and so there may be a slight risk of increased infections, and so that's something that we're going to have to watch out for and treat.
Dr. Terry Vandenhoek, thanks very much for joining us on Here and Now.
Thank you.
Dr. Terry Vandenhoek is a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Chicago.
The Aspen fire in Arizona has been raging for weeks now, blackening more than 80,000 acres of land and destroying hundreds of homes. Officials say they hope to have the western flank of the fire under control by the end of today, but they expect it to take another week until the fire is fully contained. Meanwhile, fish and game authorities in Arizona are worried about the after effects of the fire, like what happens to the fish when all that ash starts clogging the rivers there. One rare fish they have managed to rescue is known as the Gila chub. Rob Batasso is the native fish program manager with the Arizona Game and Fish Department. Hello, Rob.
Hello.
You know, I would imagine this is a topic that most of us don't encounter every day. How is it that you were evacuating fish?
Well, the threats posed by the fire were indirect in that if we have our typical monsoon rains falling after the fire has been taken care of, there's a potential for toxic ash to flush through the system and kill every fish within the stream.
And how do you go about getting them out?
standard fisheries techniques, such things as hoop nets baited with things like cat food, and minnow traps, likewise baited. And there's a device called a backpack electrofisher that puts a low amperage charge into the water that stuns the fish and allows us to pull them out with dip nets and doesn't hurt the fish.
Give me a mental image here. Are you literally pulling on the waders and marching out into the middle of the stream to do this?
Yeah, basically everybody put on their hip boots or their chest waders and just got into the pools and into the creek and pulled out the gear and collected fish.
Tell us what's important about this fish in particular. Why was it crucial to save the Gila chub?
The species overall throughout its range is in decline, has been in decline for decades, basically. It's a candidate species for endangered status. The population that's found in Sabino Canyon is considered by some ichthyologists to be genetically unique and therefore even more in need of special protection.
Now, yesterday we reported about the catfish in the Salt River in Arizona. Those were apparently killed off by ash from last year's fire, but the catfish were the bad fish, right? And so the Gila chub are the good fish?
It's relative. I mean, they serve different functions. The flathead catfish are a popular sport fish in the state. They're not a native species, but they do have a constituency of advocates. On the other hand, the Gila chub is a native species. It's not only native to Arizona, it's endemic, which means it's found nowhere else in the world. So on the one side, you've got recreational interests, and on the other side, you have biodiversity interests.
But the catfish were bad because they ate everything else?
Well, the catfish are, yeah, predatory fish, so they had an impact on the ecosystem when they were introduced into the state, including into the Salt River. I guess bad is kind of a relative term, but I won't make any value judgments on the species, but it is a voracious predator, and it did have a known negative impact to our native species.
What happens to the Gila chub now?
The fish that were salvaged have been placed in three separate locations under the notion that we'll spread our eggs into multiple baskets in case anything happens. One population is now at the University of Arizona, another at the Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum, and a third group of fish is at our state game and fish hatchery, Bubbling Ponds. So they'll be kept there for a maximum of 12 months. We think within that time the threats should have subsided, both from fire and runoff. We left quite a few fish behind in Sabino Canyon itself. We did that intentionally, given the fact that we're not certain that a toxic flow will go through the drainage.
Well, thanks for keeping us up to date on this, Rob, and good luck to the Gila chub.
Thank you much.
Rob Batasso is the Native Fish Program Manager with the Arizona Game and Fish Department. He spoke to us from Phoenix, where it was a balmy 113 degrees.
You're listening to Here and Now. It is Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
In response to our story about genetically modified food labeling in Europe, listener Brian Merrick writes, I thought it was misleading and irresponsible to present only the American food industry's perspective without mentioning why the European Union wants labeling. The fact that GMOs have not been proven safe in any long-term sense and their production has profound implications for ecosystems worldwide. The Europeans are keenly aware of this and won't buy these foods, whereas the American public, duped by the government and greedy corporations, blithely ingest anything with FDA approval.
Well, our interview about dioxin in our meat and dairy products brought us this email from a listener. On bad air days, don't breathe. Poisonous meat and milk and fish, don't eat. Your attitude implies that we all should simply accept the fact that we and our children are being slowly poisoned, and there's no point in looking at whether we should be trying to prevent it. I was more than disturbed by your matter-of-fact acceptance than by the terrifying findings of the study.
In our July 4th editorial roundtable, Carol Cerullo from Philadelphia was disappointed and surprised when Pat Walker from the Bucks County Courier-Times did not mention the brand-spanking new $160 million Constitution Center near the Liberty Bell. Well, our apologies to you, Carol. Pat Walker did mention the new Constitution Center in our interview, which was recorded just a bit before the show. That part of the conversation ended up on the editing room floor because of a time crunch.
Well, yesterday's mixed berry and peach cake prepared by resident chef Kathy Gunst prompted many of you to call in and ask for the recipe. Also, some were confused about what size springform pan Kathy used. Well, according to Kathy, a 10-inch springform pan will do. As for the recipe, go to our website at here-now.org.
But our weekly food segments do not sit so well with listener Erica Usher, who tunes in to us on WHYY in Philadelphia. Erica writes, "Drop the food segments. Tastes do not translate by word. Ever heard of cooking tapes while you're driving? Not likely, ever."
And finally, we confused several attentive music fans in our interview with members of the jazz trio Bad Plus. We played an Aphex Twin song that Bad Plus covers, but we confused the title of that song with the title of a Bad Plus original piece called Boo-Wah. The Aphex Twin song is called Flim. Our mistake and our apologies to both Aphex Twin and Bad Plus. So for fans of both, here's the Aphex Twin version of Flim, followed by the Bad Plus cover.
And as always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town.
And stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Eddie Palmieri has led Latin jazz and dance bands for over 40 years. He was raised in New York, is of Puerto Rican and Italian descent, and is an absolutely incredible pianist. Here he is on the piano from his new CD with vocalist Germán Oliveros.
Palmieri la perfecta, tocando ya la fiesta. Porque ya tocan el tema, el ritmo caliente, le gusta a la gente, el ritmo con salsa, con trombón y flauta.
Voy a gozar, voy a bailar con la perfecta,
que ritmo caliente.
That's a bit of Ritmo Caliente number 2 from Eddie Palmieri's latest release, which is called Ritmo Caliente. And Here and Now's Latin music lover Jose Masso is in the studio to tell us more about this new recording. Welcome, Jose.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Jose, we know you're a great fan of Eddie Palmieri. How could you not be? Tell us what you love most about this man and his music.
Well, There are several things, of course. One is the fact that as a pianist, he is basically taking what is the standard style of playing Afro-Cuban music and put it in different levels, including classical, including jazz. But also as a personality, he is the one who's keeping the flame alive, if you will, of those great bands from the 1950s, from the Palladium era, Tito Puente, Machito and his Afro-Cuban bands, José Curbelo, Tito Rodriguez, whom he played with, and also his older brother who passed away, Charlie Palmieri and Johnny Pacheco. And so right now, with the death of Tito Puente 3 years ago, Eddie has now become the keeper of the flame, and he's the one who's kept this type of music alive, both in dance and in jazz, Latin jazz. But most importantly, it's the fact that he's able to get anybody who wants to get on the dance floor on the dance floor.
Yeah. As he does on his new album, Ritmo Caliente, Hot Rhythm. How do you like it?
I love it. And the thing about this is that for many years, Eddie would not play music that he had originally recorded back in the early 1960s with his first band called La Perfecta, which featured two trombonists, one of them by the name of Barry Rogers, who is renowned as being one of the most instrumental in changing the sound of Latin music, the style that he played his trombone with. And he influenced people like Willie Colon and Papo Vasquez, another young trombonist from the Afro-Latin genre. But he would refuse to play this music after he disbanded the band in the late 1960s because he thought it would be so like sacrilegious. He said, how can I ever play that music again? Because there's no sound like the sound that Barry Rogers and Jose Rodriguez put together when I had that band. So I'm going to refuse to play it. Finally, about 2 or 3 years ago, some of the young trombonists started looking at that music and convinced them, you know, it's worth taking a look and re-recording some of those great charts. Why don't we try it a second time with a new vocalist by the name of Germán Oliveras and still having that full trombone sound with a flute and, of course, with the great piano work of Eddie Palmieri and the percussion.
Well, let's hear some music.
Bill, let's hear a selection from his previous CD titled La Perfecta Number 2, where he revisits one of his most famous tunes titled El Molestoso. In this case, it's El Molestoso 2.
Want to play this music for a long time.
For many years, and it took a lot of convincing by young trombonists by the name of Conrad Herwig and also Doug Beavers to re-record this. This includes a flute playing of a veteran Cuban flute player by the name of Eddie Selvigón. But this sound is a sound that when you hear it, it sounds as fresh and as alive as what he was recording back in the 1960s when he was just, you know, at every single dance hall that you can imagine throughout New York City and throughout Latin America. And this is the music that people such as myself grew up listening to in the 1960s and, of course, is a big influence for some of the young musicians today.
Yeah, well, let's get another taste of it.
This is from his latest CD, and this is Bach Goes Bata, in which he plays some of the Bach influences on piano, but then he introduces the bata rhythms and the bata drums from Cuba.
Cut the mastery of this guy on the piano, obviously. What else have you got?
Well, the one thing about Eddie Palmieri is that he's not afraid to take chances, and you heard that in that particular selection in which he has some classical influences, some jazz influences, of course, the Latin influence. In this next particular selection, he basically brings to us what he considers now the new voice of the Caribbean. It's his singer, Germán Oliveras, and this selection was originally written by Eddie Palmieri for a Broadway play that never took place. It was going to be a musical. It was going to feature some great musicians and singers from Puerto Rico. And then since it didn't happen, he decided to include it in this album. And very much this sort of like is the theme, if you will, where he's going with Afro-Latin music, and in particular, how he feels this music is now the voice of the Caribbean. And this is the title track, or the selection title, La Voz del Caribe.
De rumba guaracha, te canto de son la voz.
before that last cut, you said where he's going. He's a guy in his 70s who's still looking very much to the forward.
He is, and he's someone who is very much grounded with the music of yesterday, so he knows his roots, but someone who's got an ear as to what's happening around the world. He travels extensively. He tours Europe and other parts of the world and therefore is influenced by the sounds that he hears. But at the same time, he's very proud of his roots. You know, his family is from Puerto Rico and, of course, of Italian lineage on his father's side. But when you hear him speak about being Puerto Rican, and in this particular cut, he speaks through the music and the song of Germán Oliveras of being a Puerto Rican from New York. And he says, don't be confused, the fact that I was born in New York. I'm very much a Puerto Rican. I'm very much part of Puerto Rico and the roots that that means for me as a Puerto Rican. So he's someone who is at the same time on the cutting edge of the social commentary, of the political issues that are occurring around Puerto Rico and Latin America, and thus through his music sort of like exemplifies this. And of course, the best part of seeing Eddie is live, because he's quite the show person, he's quite the personality, and he's someone that once he sits at the piano, you don't know where he's going to go with it. So sometimes he may take a long introduction of just a piano solo, and then all of a sudden the band cooks, and then you're dancing, and you're just having a good time, you don't want him to stop. And the percussion is a very important element of what he does. This next selection that we're going to hear, Lo que traigo sabroso, number 2, is an example of the percussion in the music of Eddie Palmieri. Absolutely impossible not to start jumping around in the studio when Eddie Palmieri's on. What are we going to go out with? Well, this particular selection is from the previous CD. And as I stated, this is sort of like two CDs that go hand in hand. The previous one was called La Perfecta No. 2 and the latest Ritmo Caliente. From La Perfecta No. 2, this is an instrumental which is titled Our Routine. It's a long piece featuring Joe Santiago on bass and some great sax work by Mario Rivera on baritone and Ivan Renta on tenor sax. But the beginning is very interesting because he includes his grandson, and he talks about the fact that his grandson will always be in the studio when they record, and they have a certain routine. So here it is, Our Routine, Eddie Palmieri.
I hear that my grandson Ignacio is here. Ignacio, are you here?
I'm over here.
Keeping it in the family with Eddie Palmieri. And Jose, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about the great Eddie Palmieri. Here in Now's Latin music lover, Jose Masso is host of Con Salsa on WBUR in Boston. For more information on Eddie Palmieri's latest release, Ritmo Caliente, visit our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.